This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. In recent weeks, Michigan's undergone a sea change in its thinking about one of the state's key historical figures. The state legislature has voted to rename the Lewis Cass Building in Lansing as the Elliott Larson Building. And there's been a lot of public debate whether Cass Tech in Detroit or Cass Avenue might be ripe for a rename as well. There are many other spots around the state bearing the name of Lewis Cass. We thought it was a good time to remember his legacy and why it's so problematic. The Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark joins us for some context. Hey, Rachel.
Hi.
So Lewis Cass ended his career with a long string of titles: territorial governor of Michigan, U.S. senator, aspiring presidential candidate, secretary of war under Andrew Jackson, executor of genocide. This man had a very long career. But where did he come from and how did he end up in Michigan?
He actually was from out east in New Hampshire, and his military career sort of brought him here. So he started buying up a lot of land in the Detroit area in the 1830s. And he was territorial governor, as you said, from 1813 to 1831. So his political career actually is what brought him here, and his military career. He came here early.
His tenure leading what we now know as Michigan, in this time he was responsible for negotiating treaties with Native people.
He was.
He also led an expedition through the region all the way up into present-day Minnesota. It sounds like he never quite gave up the idea of himself as a doer of things.
No, he had great ideas of what the territory of Michigan could become. And so he was partially responsible, he and a team of essentially mapping out the early mapping out of Michigan. If you want to become a state and you want to get people to come here, you sort of have to let them know what the land looks like. So he was responsible for the mapping of the territory at that time.
How did his time as territorial governor shape the state in other political ways?
As Michigan, the territory was starting to gain popularity. He was instrumental in essentially the removal of the indigenous peoples of Michigan. Michigan wasn't new at this. This had been going on in the eastern part of the country. But in the 1820s and 1830s, he was part of this move to put treaties together to try to get the indigenous peoples of Michigan to either leave their land entirely or to move to reservations. And starting in 1820s, essentially they started in the area of what is now Wayne County, Macomb County, and then just moved up through the state, developing these very loosely based treaties. So that was sort of his legacy, as getting Michigan to become a state, because as the indigenous people either moved to the reservations or were forced to leave, then other people could come in and buy that land.
His service under President Jackson coincides with one of the most awful chapters in the United States' colonial relations with Native Americans. The Indian Removal Act was passed in 1830. Mm-hmm. What was Lewis Cass's role in enforcing that?
As he became the Secretary of War under Andrew Jackson, as I said, the treaties initially, the way they were written, allowed for the indigenous people of Michigan to stay as long as they stayed on what are now reservations. But the people who didn't do that, you have to understand the life of indigenous people, they didn't stay in one spot. They moved around a lot. And so for the indigenous people that would not go to the reservations, he forced them out militarily and was responsible for the removal and death of tens of thousands of indigenous people out of Michigan. So that was sort of his legacy as Secretary of War under Andrew Jackson. It wasn't just that time period. He had started it earlier, but because he was Secretary of War, he did have the military backing to force people out of the territory.
On top of all this, Lewis Cass was a slaveholder, was he not?
He was. Records indicate that he owned at least one slave when he was in Detroit. There's differing records of that ownership and what happened to that person. But yes, the records indicate he was a slave owner of at least one person.
Rachel, how did Michigan get to a place where someone who was so closely involved with really problematic parts of Michigan history and American history was so widely recognized as, you know, a father of the state?
I think time does interesting things to figures in history. So people argue today that he was a man of his time, and that is true. But as time went on and people looked at him as a historical figure, in the 1950s, he was revered. And as we look at him today, you know, people are really examining his role in the founding of our state, but also his role as a person who did force the indigenous people out of Michigan and was responsible for the death of indigenous people and the destruction of their culture.
The building in question in Lansing that was recently renamed, what was it called before it carried Lewis Cass's name?
It was simply called the State Office Building. It was the only one. So it was built in 1919. In 1921, it opened. And it was the only state office building that we had outside of the Capitol. So it was just called the State Office Building. And in 1951 and 52, funds were put together to build a second one. And so eventually it became time for it to have a different name.
Because there was more than one.
There was more than one. It did. And the concern was it was too confusing having this the old state office building and the new state office building. So in 1952, the Michigan Historical Commission, actually, which is a predecessor to the Michigan History Center, where I work, members of the commission petitioned the legislature to name the two state office buildings. They petitioned what was known as the old state office building to be called the Lewis Cass Building, and the new state office building was to be called the Stephen C. Mason Building. That was approved in 1952, and both buildings opened up in 52. In 51, what is now the Elliott Larson Building had a devastating fire, and it was under reconstruction. So it opened back up in 52, along with the Stephen C. Mason Building.
Rachel, the figures in the National Statuary Hall collection, have these statues ever been reconsidered in, you know, a more modern light or reinterpreted before?
They have. In 2000, U.S. Congress gave states the ability to change out their statues. Up until that point, each state was allowed two statues at their own cost as a gift to the U.S. Capitol. So in 2000, it was decided that maybe it was a good idea to reconsider some of the statues. And eight states took them up on it initially, and Michigan was one of them, to replace one of our two statues that we had there.
Who were the other figures represented in the statues in years past? I mean, Lewis Cass was always a part of it, but whose statue was there before Gerald Ford's?
Zachariah Chandler's statue was there prior to Ford. His statue was placed there in and around 1913, so he was our second statue.
Who was he?
Zachariah Chandler is an interesting person. He was born in 1813 in New Hampshire. And rather than go to university, which was sort of expected of him, he moved to Detroit in 1833 to open a store. In 1851, he was elected mayor of Detroit, and that sort of started this very long political career that he had. So by 1857, he's elected U.S. Senator from Michigan. And in 1875, he is the Secretary of Interior under Ulysses S. Grant. And throughout his time, his tenure as Secretary of the Interior, he takes that opportunity to sort of fix a lot of the corruption that he saw in Washington that had been developing over the years, but especially during the era of the Civil War. So he cleaned up corruption in the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Pension Bureau, Land Office, Patent Office, basically anywhere where he saw corruption or graft or laziness. He called for the removal of the people that were working in those departments and bureaus. But he was a very interesting person. He was on the shortlist for a presidential candidate on the Republican ticket for 1880, but he passed away in November of 1879.
Well, statues may come and statues may go. We're still waiting on that one for Elijah McCoy in the National Statuary Hall.
Yes. Yep. So currently our two statues then are Lewis Cass and Gerald Ford, who was placed in the U.S. Capitol in 2011, was the unveiling of the Ford statue.
Do you think that the reconsideration of Lewis Cass that's going on right now will be limited to that? I mean, what the closer we examine Michigan history, what else have we not been paying close enough attention to in how we tell our story?
I think that towns and cities and the state as a whole will start to look at the namesakes of their buildings or their streets or their whole town. You know, I live in a town that was named after Stephen T. Mason, who was also a slave owner. So it's a big process and it's a big conversation, but I think that those conversations are starting and I think that it's definitely time to have them. You know, there was a reason that the Cass Building was named the Cass Building in 1952, but there's a reason it's being renamed. And I think those are all conversations to have. And I think it's just really important that those continue.
I wonder if you could give us sort of a historian's take on the fact that, you know, that there is this very public, very modern public conversation going on right now of how we talk about history and whether it is truly fixed in stone or something that we continue to interpret as we grow into the place that we're going to be.
Well, I think the word that you just used is important. You said interpret. And who's doing the interpreting, who's part of that conversation, and who's at the table is the most important thing. In the 1950s, when the Cass and the Mason buildings were named, there were a very particular people at the table at the time, and they were the ones in charge of interpreting the history. So I think that it's important that the conversation continues, but also reinterpreting history. There's always information out there. There's always new things being found, but there are also new eyes looking at it and new ways of thinking about it. I'm not a professional historian. I'm an educator by trade, but in the work that I do, just looking at history with new eyes and new thinking is always important. And that will continue. And in another 30 years, we'll look at everything again. And it's just really important to continue to do that and continue to have different and new and diverse people at that table as things are being looked at.
Rachel Clark at the Michigan History Center. Rachel, thanks for walking us through this.
Thank you so much for having me.